20th-century American conservative strategy, the 38.5% of the national electorate won by Goldwater in 1964 stands as the nadir, while the 59% won by Reagan in 1984 is the apogee. George W. Bush's 50.7% support in 2004 falls in the middle statistically. However, the gaps between Reagan's level of support and Bush's jump out of the electoral details. We can distill the state-by-state performances of Reagan and Bush the younger. In the perceived cosmopolitan states of the Northeast, Great Lakes, Pacific, and Southwest, mostly blue but some red, Bush in 2004 trailed Reagan's 1984 showing by 12 to 20 points, a large and revealing shrinkage. Alabama, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee are fundamentalist and evangelical strongholds notable for their unimpressive rankings in education, mental health, child poverty, and homicide rate. These are places where church drives have been strongest, where the new fundamentalist conservatism has been most appealing. Liberals even brandish unflattering data on red state IQ measurements. In a number of West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee Appalachian counties, notable for high ratios of conservative Protestant sects, Bush gained 5 to 10 points between 2000 and 2004. Part of this increment reflected two additional decades of local spade work by church and religious right groups. In years to come, when academics complete their research, the sectarian tide in places such as Appalachia and the Ohio Valley should take on sharper definition. Both geographically and ideologically, then, the younger Bush displayed much less outreach than Reagan. This also registers in a second portrait when the state-by-state support for George W. Bush in 2004 is compared with the particulars of the 1964 Goldwater debacle. Bush's national gain of 12 points over Goldwater was unevenly arranged. In bellwethers such as Illinois, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, Bush's gains were merely average, 8 to 12 points, in line with his overall improvement over Goldwater. Where Bush built most successfully on Goldwater, gaining 20 points or more, was in the conservative old border and small town interior west, in Kentucky, West Virginia, Missouri, and Oklahoma, in Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota, as well as in Alaska and Hawaii. Most of these states are culturally conservative. In the unusual circumstances of 1964, they had been scared away by Goldwater's hawkishness, economic conservatism, and Dixiecrat seeming opposition to civil rights. By 2000 and 2004, however, they were far more amenable to an updated mixture of religious populism and political fundamentalism. In 2004, it helped that the politics seeking approval already controlled the White House, with its access to money and media, and control of the national security dialogue, and simultaneously enjoyed massive support from a well-organized network of religious organizations and churches, principally SBC, Mormon, and Pentecostal. Goldwater had nothing similar. In the early 1960s, before civil rights stridency narrowed the appeal of the Goldwater campaign, conservative strategists striving for national realignment hoped to exploit roughly the geopolitical terrain that Bush did in 2000 and 2004. While the ability of Reagan, an ex-Democrat and four-time voter for Franklin D. Roosevelt, to win Massachusetts, New York, and Hawaii was centrist icing on the Electoral College cake. Only the cake itself, baked by a bare majority of electoral votes, was constitutionally necessary. Bush did not dilute his conservatism or religiosity in search of a much larger margin. Of course, by 2004, Bush had another advantage, a politico-moral platform that neither Goldwater nor Reagan could have remotely contemplated. The 2001 attacks on Manhattan and Washington touched the national psyche in a way that created a textbook opportunity for a response rooted in the conjunction of religious and political fundamentalism. 9/11, seizing the fundamentalist moment. For months after the surprise attacks of September 11th, the public's initial panic, enemy, and fear lingered. Sleeplessness and stress faded, but even a year later, 50% of U.S. adults surveyed by CBS News felt somewhat uneasy or under danger from terrorist attacks, and 62% said they still thought about September 11th. As national attention turned to the probability of a preemptive U.S. attack on Saddam Hussein's Iraq, a few pundits and scholars began to raise a new concern. Had the public's apprehension and anxiety been molded into a new politics of good versus evil? If you're not with us, you're against us. Rigidity. A crisis-forged red, white, and blue ideology of religion, patriotism, and respect for authority. Let me call some expert witnesses. Over several years, I've built a framework of explanation derived from the work of respected experts and authors. Martin E. Marty and R. Scott Appleby, editors of the Multi-Scholar Fundamentalism Project. Charles Kimball, professor of religion at Wake Forest University and author of When Religion Becomes Evil, Five Warning Signs, 2002. Bruce Lincoln, professor of religion at the University of Chicago and author of Holy Terrors, Thinking About Religion After September 11th, 2003. David S. Domke, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Washington and author of God Willing, Political Fundamentalism in the White House, 2004. And Bruce B. Lawrence, Professor of Religious History at Duke University and author years earlier of Defenders of God, The Fundamentalist Revolt Against the Modern Age. They found much to worry about. In Fundamentalisms Observed, Marty and Appleby had explained the family resemblances between the different strong religions around the world. To begin with, fundamentalisms arise in times of crisis, real or perceived. The sense of change may be keyed to oppressive and threatening social, economic, or political conditions, but the ensuing crisis is perceived as a crisis of identity by those who fear extinction as a people. In the early 90s, the two had hypothesized that a public perception of moral unraveling in the United States was spreading such fear, but the events of September, alas, fit their definition far better. Bruce Lawrence emphasized five symptoms of fundamentalism. Among them were a predilection to impose God's will, the one true faith, on other peoples, an intolerance of dissent, and a central reliance on inerrant scripture for ideology and authority. These two seemed characteristic of the post-September 11th White House. Charles Kimball identified five principal perverse fundamentalist tendencies. 1. Claiming absolute truth. When people presume to know God, abuse sacred texts, and propagate their particular versions. 2. Seizing upon an ideal time, as in claims for imminent cataclysms or fast-approaching end times. 3. Fostering blind obedience. 4. Using ends to justify means, as in deaths or acceptance of collateral damage. And 5. Pursuing holy war, as in the Crusades, and, to some extent, the 1991 Gulf War. Inauspicious describes their applicability. Marty, Appleby, and Lawrence, writing years before September 11, 2001, had unknowingly anticipated traits of the Bush administration that were magnified in its responses to that traumatic event. In 2004, Kimball told a Baltimore interfaith meeting that he had become concerned about the indicators of a claim to absolute truth and George W. Bush's apparent belief in having a mission. Taking a second approach, Professors Lincoln and Domke analyzed the 2001 to 2005 speeches of top administration officials, for the most part those of George W. Bush himself, from the standpoint of what was said and with what apparent religious and political goals. In 2002, Lincoln had dissected Bush's October 2001 speech to the nation about his planned military response to the events of September 11th. He found the president's rhetoric to be not unlike Osama bin Laden's own statements, in that both men constructed a Manichaean struggle, where sons of light confront sons of darkness, and all must enlist on one side or the other, without possibility of neutrality, hesitation, or middle ground. While the American chief executive's words were less overtly religious than bin Laden's, Lincoln described a double coding through which Bush signaled attentive Bible readers that he shared their private scriptural invocations. Using phrases from the Revelation of St. John, 6:15-17, about the wrath of the Lamb, and Isaiah, about evildoers hiding in caves and the lonely paths of the godless. Later, the Chicago theologian subjected the text of Bush's 2004 acceptance speech to the Republican National Convention to the same kind of double-coding analysis. In addition to a single paragraph on abortion and gay marriage, early on, Bush spoke of hills to climb and seeing the valley below, an allusion to Israel's escape from slavery and Moses' vision of the Promised Land as described in Deuteronomy 34. Then, with respect to Afghanistan, Iraq, the war on terror, and the economy, he described losses overcome through hope, steadfastness, and faith. Only in Bush's culminating example, said Lincoln, did he name what he saw in them all. For as long as our country stands, he, Bush, proclaimed, people will look to the resurrection of New York City, and they will say, here buildings fell, and here a nation rose. Resurrection. Lower Manhattan may be a case in point, but it was not the point of the story. The president used the phrase, I believe, 12 times, added Lincoln, and two of the references were meant to justify his wars as holy. The first, I believe that America is called to lead the cause of freedom in a new century, prompts a question. Called by whom? The second helps answer that query. I believe freedom is not America's gift to the world. It is the Almighty's gift to every man and woman. The man in the White House was becoming America's preacher in chief. Domke, in God Willing and subsequent comments, flatly contended that Bush had pulled together a religious fundamentalist worldview with political language to create a political fundamentalism acceptable to Americans in the aftermath of September 11th. Liberty and freedom, Domke interpreted, were set out as the God-defined norm for which Americans were fighting, both in Iraq and in the War on Terror, and which Bush propounded as the ultimate remedy against both fear and terror. To Domke, the White House marketed the universal gospel of freedom and liberty as a blessing that the president attributed to God, therefore, in effect, sending an implicit message, sometimes almost explicit, that he and the U.S. government were carrying out God's own wishes. In a later analysis of Bush's September 2004 speech accepting the GOP nomination, Domke found the same clarion. I believe that America is called to lead the cause of freedom in the new century. 4 months later, Domke noted that in Bush's January 2005 State of the Union speech, the president had used the words freedom and liberty in some form 34 times, following 49 citations in his second inaugural address 2 weeks earlier. The president's linkage of freedom and liberty with divine wishes, Domke concluded, is indicative of how central an evangelical worldview is to his conception of the United States' role in the post-9/11 world. The U.S. government is doing God's work. As expert testimony, these remarks cohere powerfully around discomfort over Bush's sense of religious mission and seeming presumption that God speaks through him. Martin Marty commented in 2003 that after September 11th and the president's decision to attack Iraq, the talk that other nations found mildly amusing or merely arrogant has taken on international and historical significance. Appleby worried that Bush's global gospel of freedom and liberty was a theological version of manifest destiny. Kimball expressed concern about Bush's sense of mission, and Lincoln regretted that George W. Bush believes God has called him to be president. You won't hear him say so openly, of course, but he regularly conveys this to a core constituency, the religious right. Domke also elaborated that Bush's fusion of a religious outlook with administration policy is a striking shift in rhetoric. Other presidents petitioned for blessings and guidance. Bush positions himself as a prophet, speaking for God. In mid-2004, when George W. Bush was campaigning among the Old Order Amish in south-central Pennsylvania, The Lancaster New Era ran a report that he told one gathering, "I trust God speaks through me. Without that, I couldn't do my job." That same summer, Time commented that however often Bush defends Islam as a religion of peace, his case for war now rests less on high-fiber geopolitical arguments than on the suggestion that the 3rd Infantry Division be used as an instrument of God's will to share the gifts of liberty with all people. No analysis of the intertwining of Bible and state in Washington can ignore this kind of accumulating evidence and interpretation. Initially, this twinning of religion and politics paid major political dividends in the public opinion polls. So did maintaining the public's dual fear and belligerence with presidential orations about evil ones, reports of new leads on this or that investigation, and upward and downward revision of the color-coded terror threat levels. Yellow, orange, then yellow again. Rhetoric from Washington so frequently interspersed sentences about Islamic terrorism and Osama bin Laden with references to Saddam Hussein and Iraqi evil that much of Bush's religious electorate muddled them into one dire threat and danger to the United States, as we will see. By 2004 and 2005, the presidential campaign dialogue, the deterioration of the American position in Iraq, and the White House intervention prompted by the religious right in the Terry Schiavo right to die case began to clarify the sea change underway in the United States. Besides changing the nature of the Republican-Democratic Party competition, the Southernization of American governance and religion was abetting far-reaching ideological change and eroding the separation of powers between church and state. The theology soaking into U.S. politics was also bringing hints of theocracy, to which we now turn. The emerging Republican theocracy? Theocracy, some degree of rule by religion, has been an anathema in the modern United States. But the confusion over early 21st century trends can be clarified, although not resolved, by trying a simple multiple-choice question. Is theocracy in the United States, 1, a legitimate fear, as some liberals argue, 2, a joke, given the rising secular population, the continuing obscenity and violence from Hollywood, the brothels and gambling in Nevada, and the gay marriage services in San Francisco? 3, a worrisome bias of several major GOP constituencies and pressure groups? Or 4, all of the above? The answer, of course, is all of the above. Conservatives fixate on the provocations and ignore the excesses visible in the neo-Puritan and rightist countertide, and liberals have reversed the error, keening over the religious threat while ignoring the secular provocation. The balance of danger, however, has been redefined by the momentum of the Bush-era counterattack. To be sure, any incipient theocracy in the 21st century United States would bear little resemblance to the stereotypical precedents. John Calvin's 16th century Geneva, or John Winthrop's 17th century church-run Massachusetts Bay Colony. Those, as suggested earlier, were the products of small but intense religious migrations. In a nation approaching 300 million in population and stretching between the Atlantic and Pacific, diversity alone ensures major differences. However, we can all too plausibly contemplate a recent watershed in which fundamentalist and evangelical churches play the dominant organizational role in supporting the Republican Party that other groups, business, labor, farm, pro and anti-slavery, enjoyed in earlier presidential cycles. This could induce red state Republican conventions to proclaim the United States a Christian nation, endorse anti-homosexual and anti-abortion amendments to the Constitution, and urge that the United States withdraw from the United Nations, which they see as an auxiliary of the Antichrist. Indeed, all of this has happened. In such a milieu, not only would the major parties group around religious attendance or secularism, but they would emphasize issues with theological importance. Public schools and textbooks would be pressured toward prayer and theological correctness on matters ranging from science and evolution to sex education, family life, and foreign policy. Governments would be urged to restrain public morality at odds with interpretations of the Bible, shifting their regulatory preoccupation away from business, the economy, or the environment to issues of life and death, sex, and family. Candidates for Republican presidential or U.S. Supreme Court nominations would be vetted by little-known private groups like the Council for National Policy, the Family Research Council, and the Federalist Society. Senior Pentagon generals, in turn, would tour friendly churches in uniform, advancing thinly disguised endorsements of holy war in the Middle East. Books about end times and Armageddon would surge to the top of the bestseller lists and convince the television networks to undertake similar dramatic programming. U.S. delegates to global AIDS and women's conferences would oppose contraception, offering abstinence as Washington's solution. Fewer foreign scientists and professionals would come to the United States, while some already resident would leave. Demographers might report signs of gay influxes come ghettoization in blue states like Massachusetts, New York, and California. While it sounds a bit like political science fiction framed this way, the evidence everywhere was well in hand by 2005. Even while Democrats left in place a three-decade secularist trend in the makeup of their party cadres and conventions, Republican efforts to mobilize churches and churchgoers reached new fervor during the 2004 election campaign. According to Mark Silk, white conservative evangelical churches have become, across the South, the organizational engine for the Republican Party, the way labor unions became the organizational engine for the Democratic Party in the industrial heartland during the 1930s. Others likened the constituency benefits of the Bush administration's faith-based initiatives in funding public services through church-related groups to the advantages Democratic constituencies enjoyed from the Works Progress Administration outlays of the New Deal years or the War on Poverty under Lyndon Johnson. Activists on both sides see political culture wars turning into theological soul wars. Liberal evangelist Jim Wallace commented in 2004 that we are now in a debate for the heart and soul of what it means to be religious and political. Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention observed that a fault line ran through the denominations, with moral absolutists on the one hand versus those who see shades of gray on the other. Religion's role is increasing and will only continue to increase. To conservative Dr. Janice Krause of Concerned Women for America, the religious gap really is a divide along faith lines, I think. It's a divide that says there are human solutions to our problems and there are faith-based solutions. Under Bush, this new political theology also began to reshape America's dialogue with the rest of the world. Jacques Delors, the former European Commission president, added that the clash between those who believe and those who don't believe will be a dominant aspect of relations between the United States and Europe in the coming years. Dominique Moisy, another well-known commentator, shed light on the U.S.-European divergence. The combination of religion and nationalism in America is frightening. We feel betrayed by God and by nationalism, which is why we are building the European Union as a barrier to religious warfare. Within the United States, the religious mobilization of 2004 was extraordinary. In the South, voting by regular church attenders soared, partly because Republicans sought high November turnout among the faithful to ensure against another failure to carry the national popular vote as in 2000. Supposedly tight states, such as Florida, Tennessee, and Arkansas, turned out not to be. However, in the spring, as tight races became likely between Bush and Kerry in Pennsylvania and the Midwest, the Bush campaign and its religious allies had stepped up their efforts. In June, GOP emails leaked to the press describing how Bush forces planned to enlist churches around the nation in distributing political information and registering voters. In Pennsylvania, the Bush-Cheney campaign sought to identify 1,600 friendly congregations where voters friendly to President Bush might gather on a regular basis. Even Richard Land thought that went too far, and the Reverend Barry Lynn, executive director of the Liberal Americans United for Separation of Church and State, observed, "I never thought that anyone could so attempt to meld a political party with a network of religious organizations." However, this was only the tip of a large iceberg, and the administration's religious allies were often out in front rather than waiting for instructions. According to a post-election analysis by the Washington Post, national religious leaders and their lawyers also made a concerted effort to persuade pastors to disregard the warnings of secular groups about what churches can and cannot do in the political arena. Jay Sekulow, chief counsel of the American Center for Law and Justice, which was launched in the 1990s by Pat Robertson, advised in a mailing to 45,000 churches that short of endorsing a candidate by name from the pulpit, they were free to do almost anything. And he later told the Post that thousands of clergy members gave sermons about the election, and that many went further than they ever had before. Catholics were a particular target across several states in the Industrial Belt. Overall, the GOP campaign appointed 50,000 Catholic team leaders at the local level, and while meeting with the Pope in June, Bush asked the Vatican to push the American Catholic bishops to be more aggressive politically on family and life issues, especially a constitutional amendment that would define marriage as a union between a man and a woman. During the summer, the National Catholic Reporter posted a story on its website that the Republican National Committee had asked pro-Bush Catholics to provide its Catholic outreach unit with copies of their parish directories to help identify potential supporters. In Ohio, Bush's share of the Catholic vote rose from 50% in 2000 to 55% in 2004. The jump was greater still in rural and small-town German Catholic centers, a century ago Ohio's top Democratic strongholds. Mercer and Putnam, the state's two most heavily Catholic counties, went 3-1 for Bush in 2004, his top percentages. Warren County in southwest Ohio, touted for its outer suburban GOP gains, also had a religious factor at work. According to a 2000 religious census, Southern Baptists were the most numerous Protestant denomination there, one of only six such Ohio counties. The six were Butler, Greene, Montgomery, Pike, Preble, and Warren. Traditional Catholics, conservative Protestant evangelicals, and fundamentalists were vital in Ohio to offset the Democratic gains from high black turnout in the Cleveland area and from uneasy mainline Protestants and Yankee suburbanites in the Cleveland metropolitan area. The GOP weakness in Greater Cleveland, the one-time Western Reserve of Connecticut, and reliance on the German and Southern settled areas reversed the geography of Ohio's post-Civil War party coalitions. John Green, the Ohio-based religious voting expert, explained the centrality of the Midwest as a religious crossroads and melting pot. One reason why Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania are so competitive is that they have a lot of centrist groups. Groups that he puts into this category include Catholics, Lutherans, and Methodists. Green also explained Iowa's shift from Gore in 2000 to Bush in 2004 by indicating that close to a third of the voters this time were white born-again Protestants, reflecting their large turnout. Bush's big gains over 2000 came in western Iowa, mostly in counties with unusual concentrations of holiness or German-Dutch Reform denominations. Not coincidentally, Iowa is where Pat Robertson surprised and beat the elder George Bush in the 1988 GOP presidential caucuses. In 2004, the Bush family profited from the high churchgoer participation so discomfiting 16 years earlier. Nor did the politico-religious mobilization end there. New plans were quickly afoot in pivotal Ohio. By early 2005, the Southern Baptist Convention, already a force in southwestern Ohio, announced that metropolitan Cleveland had been selected as its one national strategic focus city for 2006 to 2007. Backed by a budget of $2.5 million, thousands of volunteers from all over the country would converge to help win converts and start new churches. Before long, local Christian conservatives announced the Ohio Restoration Project, a plan to marshal evangelical, Baptist, Pentecostal, and Roman Catholic leaders as so-called patriot pastors to take control of the Republican Party and elect a born-again governor in 2006. While this stops short of a merger of church and state, the potential for important constituencies to nudge the Republican Party in a theocratic direction has a little heralded historic dimension. Several of its vital denominational allies exemplify a political closeness to government. The Southern Baptist Convention, as we have seen, is regarded by some as more or less the unofficial state church in Dixie. Indeed, studies suggest that Northerners moving to the South frequently join it, not least Newt Gingrich, the former Pennsylvanian. Moreover, since the 1990s, the SBC's moderate liberal opposition faction has criticized the dominant conservatives for getting too close to Washington and soft-peddling the church's historic commitment to separation of church and state. One SBC moderate liberal, Will D. Campbell, wrote a novel, The Convention, 1988, in which the SBC is renamed the Federal Baptist Church and is by the end of the book indistinguishable from a political party. The major Pentecostal denomination, the Assemblies of God, has worked closely with the Republicans ever since the Robertson presidential campaign, perhaps reflecting Robertson's own disdain for church-state separation. His Pentecostal allies, as noted earlier, pushed blatantly theocratic resolutions at state Republican conventions. John Ashcroft of Missouri, a dedicated Assemblies of God layman, became a particular target for proponents of strict church-state separation because of the new Justice Department units and policies he developed as George W. Bush's first Attorney General. The church history of the Mormons, in turn, could fill a book, and often has, with what one chronicler summed up as its polygamous family structure, ritual worship practices, secret oaths, open canon, economic communalism, and theocratic politics. The Church of the Latter-day Saints was the last U.S. regional theocracy, continuing that way into the early 20th century, and the title of its president, officially President, Prophet, Seer, and Revelator, still reflects that heritage. Philip Goff, director of the Center for the Study of Religion and American Culture, emphasizes that over the last 100 years, the Mormons did much more than survive. The Latter-day Saints created a de facto establishment of religion in the inner Mountain West that continues to this day. The Mormon analogy that Baptist-watching historian Paul Harvey sees, not surprisingly, is to the parallel accomplishments of the Southern Baptist Convention. Finally, the two major Lutheran denominations also tap a tradition of accommodating state power. The Missouri Synod Lutherans, arch-conservative and corporatist, regarded theirs as the one true church, followed the word of the Bible, upheld male authority, kept the German language as long as they could, and separated themselves from other faiths through parochial schools and church-related organizations. The evangelical Lutherans, as we have seen, came together in several stages from the multiplicity of German, Danish, Norwegian, Swedish, and Finnish Lutheran churches of the Upper Midwest, many of which were offshoots of state churches in the Old Country. Door County, Wisconsin, has enough of an Icelandic fishing community to support an Icelandic Lutheran church. The SBC, Mormon, and Lutheran churches are the three Protestant denominations in the United States with the sort of strong regional preeminence that in itself breeds a powerful clerical closeness to everyday community governance and political authority. It is in their core strongholds, places like the West Texas Bible Belt, Greater Utah, and the Northern Plains, that U.S. churches have their highest ratios of adherence. Community pressure and conformity would be substantial. It is no coincidence that the geography of the three denominations is also a religious map of the Republican Party's church-going ascendancy. The rise of the religious right has been yet another force for potential theocracy. Its intense political motivation pivots in part on genuine belief that religion must regain the place in the public life that it enjoyed in the early days of the Republic, when Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire lawfully maintained established congregational churches. But the challenge of such a restoration, many feel, is so huge that gaining sway over government is necessary to rebuild that religious component. This, in one of its harsher forms, is the premise of Christian Reconstructionism, a radical theology that will be examined in Chapter 7. While most religious right leaders have given lip service to church-state separation, many have periodically let the mask slip, and sometimes slip badly. Jerry Falwell has said, "I hope I live to see the day when, as in the early days of our country, we won't have any public schools. The churches will have taken them over again, and Christians will be running them." Bob Jones III, president of the politically attuned university bearing that name, opined that the so-called wall of separation between church and state is a liberal fabrication to try to put churches out of a place of influence in political life. In 2004, he congratulated George W. Bush on his re-election, urging him to press pro-family legislation in keeping with Scripture. The Reverend Sun Yung Moon, the owner of the Washington Times and the head of the well-funded Unification Church, said that we must have an autocratic theocracy to rule the world. So we cannot separate the political field from the religious. My dream is to organize a Christian political party including the Protestant denominations, Catholic, and all religious sects. We can embrace the religious world in one arm and the political world in the other. Moon, somewhat surprisingly, has been close to the Bush family, having been praised by the senior Bush in a 1996 speech. Then in 2001, Moon co-hosted George W. Bush's inaugural prayer lunch. To Pentecostal Pat Robertson, ever blunt, there is no way that government can operate successfully unless led by godly men and women under the laws of the God of Jacob. For all practical purposes, Robertson is a Christian Reconstructionist. His Virginia educational complex bears the name Regent University because a regent is one who governs in the absence of a sovereign, and Regent University is a kingdom institution for grooming God's representatives on the face of the earth to serve until the return of Jesus. However, as political operators like George's Ralph Reed acknowledged years back regarding the tactics of the Christian coalition, stealth is a major premise, furtiveness a byword. The Christian right usually does not like to acknowledge what it is doing or where. The point is to minimize public attention to its influence and backstairs power. A half century ago, before the election of John F. Kennedy as president, many Americans feared, in a carryover of 19th century tensions and suspicions, that Roman Catholicism might someday threaten America with church power and theocracy. Especially since the Vatican II reforms of the 1960s, that psychology has reversed, with current theocratic inclinations in the United States concentrated among conservative Protestants. Pew Center polls found that while majorities of Protestants, particularly evangelicals, acknowledged that their personal religious views and faith influenced their voting, only 32% of Catholics did. Polling by ABC News in May 2004 found the following rank order of support for religious leaders trying to influence politics. White conservative evangelicals, 62%. White church-going evangelicals, 53%. White evangelical Protestants, 46%. Evangelical Protestants, 43%. Catholics, 34%. Non-evangelical Protestants, 27%. Persons with no religion, 22%. To amplify this point, in 2004, rank-and-file Catholics by 72% to 22% opposed Roman Catholic bishops denying communion to politicians who supported abortion rights. Gary Bauer, a leader of the religious right, captured the irony. When John F. Kennedy made his famous speech that the Vatican would not tell him what to do, evangelicals and Southern Baptists breathed a sigh of relief. But today, evangelicals and Southern Baptists are hoping that the Vatican will tell Catholic politicians what to do. As for the leanings of key GOP leaders, much of the attention focused on George W. Bush and Tom DeLay, the Republican House Majority Leader, who openly said, "God is using me all the time, everywhere, to stand up for a biblical worldview in everything that I do and everywhere I am. He is training me." However, the larger tale lies in data showing that in 2004, all seven of the top Republican leaders in the U.S. Senate, starting with Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee and working down to Senator George Allen of Virginia, chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, boasted 100% ratings from the Christian Coalition, founded by Pat Robertson in the wake of his 1988 presidential bid. As of this writing, None of the half-dozen pieces of quasi-theocratic legislation drafted by the religious right and introduced in Congress by its supporters, bills like the House of Worship Free Speech Restoration Act, the First Amendment Restoration Act, and the Constitution Restoration Act, had achieved passage, but the time could come. These and others are glowingly described on the website of the Christian Coalition. Political correctness on the left has been surpassed by its theological equivalent on the right, and 2005 saw the first Republican member of Congress stand up and say so. Congressman Christopher Shays of Connecticut in late March 2005 sadly declared that the Republican Party of Lincoln has become a party of theocracy. A cultural adjunct to these ambitions, End Times Theory and Literature, with its audience of 50 to 100 million Americans, emerged as a big business in the United States during the 1990s, turning dozens of fundamentalist and charismatic preachers into multimillionaires, thanks to their best-selling books, videos, televised sermons and Bible hours, TV stations, and broadcast networks. Not surprisingly, most are ardent supporters of tax cuts and reduced economic regulation, as their faithful flocks concentrate on morality, salvation, biblical guidance, a possible rapture, and the countdown to Christ's return. These believing constituencies, in turn, want more of their government, over whatever time may be left, to come from religious institutions, with the imprimatur of a president who openly favors at least some transfer of power. Such mingling of theology, popular culture, and theocracy has already brought about aspects of an American disenlightenment, to employ a descriptive antonym. Effects can be seen in science, climatology, federal drug approval, biological research, disease control, and not least in the tension between evolution theory and the religious alternatives, creationism and so-called intelligent design. Some commentators have pictured the greatest religious threat to science since the Catholic Church in 1633 put Galileo under house arrest for heresy in stating that the earth revolved around the sun. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. The religious hawkishness, substitution of faith for reason, and missionary insistence increasingly visible in the United States have plagued leading world economic powers from Rome to Spain to Britain. It is time to turn to the theologization of American politics and the unfortunate historical precedents it calls to mind. Chapter 7. Church, State, and National Decline. One of the biggest changes in politics in my lifetime is that the delusional is no longer marginal. It has come in from the fringe to sit in the seat of power in the Oval Office and in Congress. For the first time in our history, ideology and theology hold a monopoly of power in Washington. Bill Moyers, 2004. Liberals regularly contend that one of America's two great parties is bent on creating a theocracy, backed by a solid core of somewhere between a quarter and one-third of the population. The Economist, 2005. By a series of recent initiatives, Republicans have transformed our party into the political arm of conservative Christians. The elements of this transformation have included a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, opposition to stem cell research involving both frozen embryos and human cells in petri dishes, and the extraordinary effort to keep Terry Schiavo hooked up to a feeding tube. Episcopal minister and former Republican Senator John Danforth, 2005. Religious, secular, or somewhere in between, most Americans of the early 2000s shared some concern about a broad range of threats to the nation's future. Immorality, decadence, crime, terrorism, private and public corruption, moneyed politics, greed and luxury, and the stratification of wealth and power. But how they defined them or what they chose to emphasize varied greatly. Conservatives saw a threat that was predominantly religious and moral, and the gloomy, neo-Calvinist preoccupation of important elements of the religious right emerged all too clearly in their leaders' immediate, unthinking interpretation of the meaning of September 11th. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson agreed that the United States had been attacked because of God's displeasure with secular immorality. Their comments, although quickly retracted, painted a picture of the stern Old Testament God hurling thunderbolts and death at his wayward chosen people. Secular Americans and those who only occasionally attended religious services had a somewhat different point of view. Their fears had more to do with economics, society, and the successes or failures of U.S. foreign policy. Not a few worried about the excesses of organized religion and the influence of the Christian right. Between 2001 and 2005, after the Terry Schiavo episode, national polls showed such concern doubling. Among secular voters, a startling two-thirds expressed antipathy to evangelicals. To many of the born-again, secular, as in secular humanist, was an expletive to be culturally deleted. Controversy also began to collect around the fundamentalist pulpiteers' prophecies of rapture, end times, and Armageddon. By 2005, a counterattack was apparent in mainline religious responses, Catholic and Protestant alike. This was exemplified by publications such as The Rapture Exposed, Lutheran theologian Barbara Rossing's contention that rapture theology was little better than a racket, and comparable works on the Catholic side, replete with charges that what was really left behind in Tim LaHaye's series was biblical truth. Polls are few, but those taken showed that majorities of Catholics, Lutherans, Episcopalians, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, and Methodists disbelieved in the event so central to the Left Behind books and fundamentalist Jeremiads. The historical dilemma is that while religion has generally served humankind well, certainly in framing successful societies around the world, there have been conspicuous exceptions. Bloody religious wars, malevolent crusades, and false prophecies. Indeed, the precedents of past leading world economic powers show that blind faith and religious excesses, the rapture seems to be both, have often contributed to national decline, sometimes even being in its forefront. As with Charles Kimball's five criteria for the mutation of religion, I believe that a yardstick can be set up for Rome, Habsburg Spain, the Dutch Republic, Britain, and the United States that isolates and profiles five critical symptoms of decline in the past leading world economic powers. Just as Kimball's five criteria are broadly framed and need not all be present simultaneously, one or two, he says, can be enough to suggest trouble. Likewise for these five symptoms of a power already at its peak and starting to decline. These broad categories are mine, in no firm order, and based on research for several of my books over two decades. However, the relevant history has many sources and confirmations. One symptom is widespread public concern over cultural and economic decay, with its many corollaries. The second is a growing religious fervor, church-state relationship, or crusading insistence. Next comes a rising commitment to faith as opposed to reason, and a corollary downplaying of science. Fourth, we often find a considerable popular anticipation of a millennial time frame. An epical battle, emergence of the Antichrist, or belief in an imminent second coming or Armageddon. Last, empires are prone to a hubris-driven national strategic and military overreach, often pursuing abstract international missions that the nation can no longer afford, economically or politically. I have not included high debt levels in this set of symptoms, partly because it seems a familiar facet of great power economic aging, but principally because it is the subject of Part 3 of this book. In its most deadly form, debt accompanies corrupt politics, hubris, and international overreach, and then, as we shall see, becomes crippling in its own right. The second half of this chapter will examine the five basic symptoms in the present-day United States. All are present to at least some extent. However, before we turn to these indicators, it is essential to describe how these vulnerabilities and perils made themselves felt in the past. All four nations and empires I will discuss believed in their own exceptionalism, a wellspring of encouragement and reassurance for early and middle generations, but a source of strategic blindness during the last years of illusion. Exceptionalism. the delusion that the United States is different. The four empires in question, Rome, the Spanish-centered Habsburg Empire, the Netherlands, and Great Britain, were each, in its day, the leading world economic power and the principal naval or military power. Rome's triumph spanned many centuries before clear decline set in during the 4th and 5th centuries. Spain's global heyday began in the 1490s, spanning the 16th century before crumbling during the 17th. Spain, in this imperial context, goes beyond the Iberian Peninsula because of the 16th century Habsburg dynastic tie to Italy, Austria, and Burgundy. In Empire, Henry Kamen, a prominent historian of Spain, underscores better than most how Habsburg Spain was much more than the Iberian Peninsula. A rare coincidence of inheritance brought together under the elected Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, also known as Charles I of Spain, 1516 to 1556, not just the peninsula, but also Italy, the Low Countries, Austria, and part of Germany. The four-decade union of crowns was not a full economic or political union, but it enriched the power of a Spain also lucky enough to be welcoming gold and silver fleets from the Americas. The Dutch Empire, built on the maritime piers and pilings of global commerce, rose during the 17th century and eroded during the 18th. Great Britain emerged in both industrial and naval might during the 18th century, dominated the 19th, and lost its broad hegemony during the early decades of the 20th. The symptoms analyzed here are those seen during each power's notable period of decline. No nation escaped the processes and subsequent disillusionment. Historians of great power decline do not emphasize religion, save with respect to Rome, but it has also played important roles elsewhere. These pages put religion first less because of preeminent causation. Economics and warfare have played equal or greater roles than because of this book's larger focus on the re-emergence of faith-driven politics. Edward Gibbon, in his 1776 masterwork, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, pointed to an overconfident and intolerant Christianity as the cause of imperial decline. The English historian's basic thesis was that after the late 4th century Roman Empire made a state religion of Christianity, which until then had been just a minor sect, that combination of church and state became crippling and divisive, so that religious excess helped to bring down an already weakening empire. Other historians have agreed. Michael Grant in The Fall of the Roman Empire has suggested that, by contrast, the previous polytheism had been versatile and relatively tolerant. Christian Rome, however, withdrew tolerance and pressured its regions and peoples on behalf of the one true religion. This worsened Roman relations with allied German tribes practicing a somewhat different, even heretical Christianity. Jews unhappy with a rival monotheism and adherents of the old gods that were so much a part of Roman history. In consequence, concludes Grant, what contributed above all to this decline was the application of religious coercion, for it achieved precisely the opposite of its unifying aims, powerfully accelerating the forces of disintegration and dissolution. The Emperor Constantine, the great Christian advocate, weakened Rome by splitting it into separate Eastern and Western empires, the latter soon untenable. Like Gibbon, Grant goes into considerable detail. As for Spain, its late 15th and 16th century ascent had been closely tied to Catholic faith and expansionism. The reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula from Islam, completed in 1492, the overseas missions of conquistadors, Jesuits, and priests carrying the cross to the New World, and at home the forced full conversion or expulsion of Spain's nominally converted Jewish and Muslim populations from 1492 into the early 1600s. However, further extensions of these narrow psychologies helped to bring about the nation's 17th century decline. Religious excess and the crown's preoccupations with advancing Catholicism globally are widely agreed upon as contributing factors. For one thing, Spain's religiosity deepened in the late 1500s after the conversion or expulsion of its Jews and Muslims emphasized the national commitment to Catholicism. The faith militant became the faith triumphant. New religious orders proliferated. 17 were founded in Madrid during the reign of Philip II, as did almshouses and hospitals run by groups such as the Hospitaller Brothers of St. John. Inward piety and direct communion with God increased among those in monasteries and convents, turning their faith away from church teachings. These practices and literature, although in ways heretical, were accepted as a form of mysticism. The emphasis on missionary work in the new empire, from Santo Domingo and Mexico City to Argentina and Peru, was so widespread that as late 17th century Spain lost its great power status, many churchmen consoled themselves by claiming that the spiritual conquest succeeded and the Catholic identity was Spain's greatest colonial legacy. Militant Catholicism had drained Spain in Europe, but Catholic growth in Spanish and Portuguese America continued. If one counts the cardinals from the Western Hemisphere involved in the selection of recent popes, this contention is not easily dismissed. But at home, the Spanish Inquisition, the epitome of religious coercion, helped breed a climate of orthodoxy and fear, and by the early 17th century, Spain was sagging under the weight of church bureaucracy. Between the 16th century reign of Philip II and the kingship of Philip IV, ending in 1665, the count of regular and secular clergy in Spain doubled to some 200,000, while the population as a whole did not increase. Castile itself had 9,000 religious houses just for men. Faith also took an economic toll. In the words of one prominent historian, religious festivals in some places occupied a third of the year, and the dead weight of a vast apparatus of ecclesiastical bureaucracy lay heavily on Castile. For religious reasons having to do with usury, Spanish authorities prohibited the execution of interior bills of exchange, which limited credit arrangements. Although later kings and their advisors were concerned enough to try to limit the wealth and expansion of the church, including a 1677 proposal to curb the number of the clergy, the vested interests were by then too powerful and embedded. Thus, in 1621, after multiple bankruptcies, talk of reform, and 2 decades of intermittent truces with the English, French, and Dutch, King Philip III effectively went back to imperial principles resembling those of his father, Philip II, whose belief in his role as God's viceroy had sent the unsuccessful Armada against England. The entrenched militant Catholicism was beyond reform. In the words of historian Paul Allen, "For the remainder of the century, then, Spain's monarchs and ministers would steadfastly reject reason-of-state approaches to policy in favor of providing solid support for the Catholic cause, even at the expense of Spain's empire. In so doing, they fulfilled to the letter Philip II's pious vow to Pope Pius V that rather than suffer the least damage to the Catholic Church and God's service, I will lose all my states and 100 lives if I had them." What Spain did lose was worldly power and hegemony. The Dutch nation, in addition to the resources of wind and water, also drew on the power of fierce religion. The Calvinist fervor of the Dutch Reformed Church, so prominent in the long war to break free of Spain. Militant, scriptural, and little more tolerant than Spain's Catholicism, it gained official status following the 1618 Synod of Dordrecht, despite adherence by no more than half of the Dutch people. This percentage rose in the 17th century, but then ebbed again. By the 1730s and 1740s, after Dutch trade, wealth, and power had passed their peaks, a growing influx of Catholics, Lutherans, and Jews, mostly from neighboring German territories, reduced the Dutch Reformed share of the population back toward the 50% mark. These changes angered Reformed church preachers, predicants, who ranted over the nation's immorality and lost greatness. Simon Schama noted how for prominent Orangist thinkers, it had been the Reformed religion which had blessed the war against the Spanish Antichrist with victory, and had appointed the princes of the House of Orange to be its godly captains. Between 1747 and 1751, what historian Jonathan Israel calls a second Orangist revolution restored to power the Dutch political faction, the quasi-royal House of Orange, long allied with the fundamentalist predicants. As revolutionary ideas spread, the Prussian army restored the Orangists again in 1787. During the second half of the century, as the Dutch people watched their cities, industries, and maritime capacity continue to decline, religious divisions fed two separate movements, each urging a brand of political and moral renewal. The Orangist faction, grouped around the heirs of William the Silent, hero of the 16th century Dutch Revolution, had long been loosely allied with churchmen whose agenda was to suppress Catholics, deepen church-state collaboration, and restore the nation's fading Puritan morality. The rival Patriot faction, in background and sentiment somewhat akin to the revolutionaries developing nearby in France, was reformist, more secular, and more toleration-minded, drawing substantially on Catholics, Lutherans, Mennonites, and moderate Reformed Church elements. Civil War broke out again during the 1780s and 1790s, and in 1795, French forces empowered the Patriots, who proceeded to disestablish the Dutch Reformed Church. The Church was already much less important than its equivalent was in Catholic Spain, but the divisive legacy of early Dutch religious zealotry crippled any chance of an ecumenical national renewal. The contributions of British religious enthusiasm to the country's years of decline in the early 20th century are more straightforward. A wave of missionary and evangelical religion pushed the old England of Anglican squires and cathedrals toward a new middle-class moralism during the Victorian era, following on the heels of the 18th century rise of nonconformists, Quakers, Methodists, Independents, and Jews, which had spurred so much innovation in finance, commerce, and industry. However, the evangelical wave was especially influential, as summarized by historian R.C.K. Enser in England, 1870 to 1914. No one will ever understand Victorian England who does not appreciate that among highly civilized countries, it was one of the most religious that the world has ever known. Moreover, its particular type of Christianity laid a peculiarly direct emphasis on conduct. It became, after Queen Victoria's marriage, practically the religion of the court and gripped all ranks and conditions of society. After Prime Minister Melbourne's departure, 1841, it inspired nearly every front-rank public man, save Palmerston, Prime Minister for all but 1 year between 1855 and 1865, for 4 decades. Moral pretension became a second British flag, just as it later became a second American flag. Between 1850 and 1914, the percentage of people in England attending church or chapel declined somewhat from the 40 to 50% range to 25 to 35%, largely because of disaffiliation as the population became concentrated in large cities like London, Manchester, and Liverpool. Attendance remained higher in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales, all largely nonconformist Protestant rather than high church Anglican. Wales in particular underwent a major revival as late as 1904 to 1907, a paroxysm of revelation and ecstasy so powerful that for a while crime slackened and Welsh liquor consumption fell by half, bankrupting a considerable share of tavern owners. Besides inner conversion, evangelicalism also emphasized outward conversion efforts by its adherents. As a result, the 19th century saw a huge increase in foreign missionary activity, along with an upsurge of moral imperialism, belief in Britain's duty to save the world, that abetted and reinforced the everyday patriotism of parades, naval reviews, music hall songs, and saber-rattling literature. Initial public enthusiasm for World War I, as we will see, marched in part to the stirring cadences of onward Christian soldiers. When post-war disillusionment took over, few British institutions paid a higher price than the war-drumming denominations, led by the Church of England. To summarize, religion, while not routinely cited as a significant factor in Dutch and British decline, did play a considerable part and had also played a central role in the downfalls of Rome and Spain. Fervent religion feeding into national hubris late in an imperial trajectory is a particularly worrisome historical sign that should summon caution for the present-day United States. Symptom number 2, related to the first, involves the interplay of faith and science. What might be called the Roman disenlightenment has been well dissected in Charles Freeman's The Closing of the Western Mind, 2002. He dwells on how Rome's 4th and 5th century Christian regimes closed famous libraries like the one in Alexandria, limited the availability of books, discarded the works of Aristotle and Ptolemy, and embraced the dismissal of Greek logicians set forth in the Gospel of Paul. To Freeman, the elevation of faith over logic stifled inquiry in the West, leaving the next advances to Arab mathematicians, doctors, and astronomers, and brought on intellectual stagnation. It is hard, he wrote, to see how mathematics, science, or associated disciplines that depended on empirical observations could have made any progress in this atmosphere. From the last recorded astronomical observation in 475, it would be over 1,000 years, with the publication of Copernicus's De Revolutionibus in 1543, before these studies began to move ahead again. Habsburg Spain, a second empire immersed in Catholic theology, was equally hostile to scientific inquiry. The eminent British historian of Spain, J. H. Eliot, recounted the 17th century episode when the Spanish government, deliberating over a vital canal project, assembled a junta of theologians who advised that if God had intended the rivers Tagus and Manzanares to be navigable, he would have made them so. Another historian of Iberia, Henry Kamen, quotes a visiting Italian nobleman in 1668 as saying that the ignorance is immense and the sciences are held in horror. Detailing how Spain relied on Italian and other foreign scholarship while importing needed technicians from other Catholic parts of Europe, Kamen summed up, "Spain remained prominent by its absence from the European intellectual and scientific scene." When the Royal Society of London in the 1660s began to organize its scientific links with European intellectuals, Spain did not feature. The puzzle, which still eludes any easy explanation, is why the most universal society of the globe was unable, after centuries of imperial experience, to discourse on equal terms with other European nations that shared the same background. Parenthetically, this is the same period in which the papacy found Galileo guilty of heresy and placed him under house arrest for 7 years until he recanted for propounding the Copernican argument that the earth revolved around the sun. David Landes, in The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, points out that in 1600 philosopher Giordano Bruno had been burned in Rome for much the same offense, by which the church proclaimed its intentions of taking science and imagination in hand and leashing them to Rome. Spain was even more dogmatic and medieval. That could not be said of the discovery-minded Netherlands. In the 17th century, their scientific and technological knowledge had impressed all Europe, and even in the early 18th century, the Dutch Enlightenment was the instructor of Europe in microscopic science, botany, anatomy, and medicine. But by the mid-18th century, the Republic's science was fading and its universities were losing prestige and enrollment. Most of the difficulty had to do with the general ebb of the nation's industry and economy, which shrank educational outlays and funding of facilities. Even so, after the Orangist Revolution of 1747 to 1751, the ability of the Dutch Reformed Church to influence university appointments was a damper. The scientific side of the Dutch Enlightenment withered. The impact of British evangelicalism on science was largely cultural, not heavy-handed or political. Science, as opposed to industry and exports, was not much of a cause or priority in the last decades of the 19th century. The preoccupation of Britain's elite with moral imperialism, global finance, colonial administration, foreign missions, and the great game in India, Persia, and Central Asia, to say nothing of the glamour of the household cavalry, Bengal lancers, and the world's greatest navy, had shaped upper-tier education in a different vein. Its dominant preoccupations were with gentlemanly conduct, sportsmanship and playing fields, moral principles, religion, classics, history, Athens and Sparta, Locke and Blackstone, Drake and Wellington, not engines and test tubes. After Charles Darwin published his theories of evolution, many churchmen became prominent critics of scientific inquiry. At Rugby, the famous headmaster Matthew Arnold commented that Rather than have it, science, the principal thing in my son's mind, I would gladly have him think that the sun went around the earth and that the stars were so many spangles set in the bright blue firmament. Surely the one thing needed for a Christian and Englishman to study is a Christian and moral and political philosophy. Just as the Battle of Waterloo 100 years earlier had been won on the playing fields of Eton, the technological naivete writ large in initial British enthusiasm, coupled with unreadiness for World War I, had at least some connection to the sort of elite curriculum at Rugby. But as World War I lengthened without British success, the nation's lack of adequate scientific and technological preparation became a scandal. The stuff of irate speeches in Parliament and appalled acknowledgments by government commissions charged with investigation. In The Closing of the Western Mind, Freeman suggested that late Roman faith began to create the barrier between science and rational thought in general and religion that appears to be unique to Christianity. If so, perhaps latter-day evangelical Protestantism exemplifies this tendency, given how American sects of the 1920s and again in the early 21st century challenged the science of Charles Darwin in much the same way that so many religious Britons had during the Victorian years. A third common litmus test, the economic and social polarization and decay common to the late years of our four world powers, is probably their most commented upon characteristic. Brevity, then, seems in order, and readers interested in fuller detail will find some in Chapter 4 of my book Wealth and Democracy, 2002. Rome's multifarious decay, in fact, has become a stereotype, a Hollywood drama of epicene emperors lolling on purple couches, stuffing and amusing themselves as the poor starved and Goths and Vandals cross the Rubicon. But this characterization should not be mistaken for fantasy or fiction. The decay was real. Spain's decline has also become a caricature, especially in history books that quote the arbitrista reformers of the early 17th century. One of them, González de Sayarigo, summed up that Spain has come to be an extreme contrast of rich and poor, and there is no means of adjusting them one to another. Our condition is one in which we have rich who loll at ease, and poor who beg, and we lack people of the middling sort, whom neither wealth nor poverty prevents from pursuing the rightful kind of business enjoined by natural law. Most scholars cite his views. Spanish morale was dulled by desengaño, a national disillusionment, vast bureaucracy, upper-class luxury, immorality, and political corruption. These were targeted, without any notable success, by sumptuary decrees restricting attire, by curbs on prostitution, and by abolition of unnecessary government positions and receiverships. Then, as now, such reforms rarely succeed. So, too, from mid-18th century Holland, about which the famous description came from visiting traveler James Boswell. Most of their principal towns are sadly decayed, and instead of finding every mortal employed, you meet with multitudes of poor creatures who are starving in idleness. Were Sir William Temple, a 17th century chronicler, to revisit these provinces, he would scarcely believe the alteration which they have undergone. Dutch Reformed pastors called for national renewal and incessantly attacked laziness, prostitution, French fashions, immigrants, and homosexuals. The British example, of course, is the freshest. Winston Churchill in 1908 expressed gloom that the seed of imperial ruin and national decay, the unnatural gap between the rich and the poor, the exploitation of boy labor, the physical degeneration which seems to follow so swiftly on civilized poverty, the swift increase of vulgar, jobless luxury, are the enemies of Britain. In The Strange Death of Liberal England, 1910 to 1914, George Dangerfield described 1911 as a year of London climbing towards its peak of plutocratic splendor, and tales of ballrooms banked high with the loot of hothouses, of champagne flowing like a sea, or bare backs, jeweled bosoms, and fabulous expenditure. Cultural historians have dwelt on the other upheavals and tensions of the fin de siècle. The decadence movement among literary Londoners epitomized by Oscar Wilde and Aubrey Beardsley, the estimates of 60,000 or so prostitutes in the capital, occultism, and the suffragette campaign for women's votes and women's rights. Decay always has two faces. The one displaying economic and social polarization and injustice, which always stirs complaint among progressives, and the second representing moral and cultural decadence come sophistication, which invariably stirs conservative and fundamentalist outrage. The focus of criticism can run the gamut from haute cuisine and fashion to prostitution, effete art, and homosexuality. Here, too, as we will see, the early 21st century United States is repeating portions of a familiar pattern. Our fourth hallmark involves the widespread perception of a premillenarian time frame, as when preachers talk of a war to end all wars, of Armageddon, or of Christ's imminent return. This is another way in which the influence of religion feeds a willingness for war. Late 4th century Roman Christians thought the end times might come when Rome fell to the barbarians. Spain's confidence cracked somewhat after the defeat of the Armada in 1588, when Spanish leaders had to answer English, Dutch, and Lutheran taunts that King Philip II was the Antichrist. Part of Spain's response was to captain the Counter-Reformation and the Catholic side in the draining 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648. As the Netherlands in turn embarked on a costly quarter century of alliance with England and war with France in 1689, Dutch Reformed predicants had identified their own new Antichrist, Louis XIV, the King of France. But the most disturbing late imperial premillennial focus is that of Britain from 1900 into the early years of World War I, until the national trauma of the 420,000 British casualties on the Somme in 1916. As we have seen, Britain in the second half of the 19th century was fired by evangelical religion, global missionary instincts, and the white man's burden identified by Rudyard Kipling. Onward, Christian Soldiers, the great martial hymn published in 1871, boasted triumphal music by Sir Arthur Sullivan, of Gilbert and Sullivan fame. Something of an imperialist, Sullivan in 1900 composed a Te Deum to celebrate the imminent victory in the Boer War, but it could not be played until 1902, after his death. Music hall jingoism, militant Protestant hymnology, and queen and country literature converged. Much as the male population of the United States rose during the 1980s and 1990s to the excitement of renewed gunboat diplomacy, the 1986 bomber strike on Tripoli, Libya, and invasions, Grenada, Panama, and the Gulf War, as well as endless fictional high-tech combat thrillers of the sort pioneered by Tom Clancy, British males did much the same thing between 1890 and 1914. Cecil Eby, an American professor, has tabulated the drum rolls and bugle calls. By 1889, 40,000 brass bands existed in Britain, playing more military marches than anything else. 500 music halls in London alone belted out patriotic choruses. Between 1871 and 1914, in addition, English fiction writers turned out 60 books about foreign invasions of Britain, 41 German, 18 French. In none of these volumes was Britain the aggressor, but even in Boy Scout and cricket uniforms, young British males were preparing for the great match to come. Preachers and prophets also had their eyes on the clock. Charles T. Russell, leader of the U.S.-based Jehovah's Witnesses, forecast Armageddon in 1914, and the word was on many European lips. However, instead of being the war to end all wars, the great match became the war to end the British Empire. Its conclusion in the cynical Peace of Versailles in 1919 set the scene for a follow-up 20 years later that finished off what was left of British overseas investment and the reveries of 19th century headmasters. A fifth bellwether of imperial decline, already suggested in Part 1, lies in the seeming inability of leading powers to avoid dangerous overreach in international commitment, and in foreign military involvement and its cost. These decisions can seem necessary, or at least plausible at the time, with hubris helping. The unwise economic, political, and military overstretch usually becomes entirely clear only in retrospect, although sometimes it does not take long. Rome, for example, was obliged to defend some far-flung frontiers in North Africa and along the Rhine and Danube. However, historians fault both the choice of perimeters and the draining expense of large armies and extravagant frontier defensive systems, most of which were never attacked as the empire rotted from within and foes came from unexpected directions. For the Spanish, Dutch, and British, the costs of war and empire became problems within a generation or two of their imperial zeniths. The economic impact in trade and debt will be discussed in Part 3, but it is appropriate here to note the conflicts that did so much damage. For Spain, the